From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. As the U.S. military continues to bomb Afghanistan, we'll look at the war at home with theologian, scholar, activist Cornel West, speaking about the challenge of progressive politics after September 11th. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Afghan troops said they're preparing to attack a mountain hideout where the Taliban leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, is said to have fled with 500 men. 10 days after the fall of Kandahar, the city's intelligence chief said that Mullah Omar has been traced to a mountain hideout northwest of the city. He said that ethnic Pashtun forces were hunting him, and when they found him, they would hang him. U.S. forces are continuing to hunt for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda forces. But after killing thousands of Afghan civilians and forcing hundreds of thousands to flee their homes, War Department officials admit it's anybody's guess where either bin Laden or Muhammad Omar have gone. Two U.S. warplanes came under fire from surface-to-air missiles in Afghanistan today. Neither plane was hit. A Marine spokesperson said the missiles may have been shoulder-fired Stingers built for the U.S. infantry and secretly supplied to Afghan Mujahideen fighting the Soviet occupation in the 1980s. The London Independent is reporting there are strong indications that the United States is preparing contingency plans to launch attacks on Somalia from bases in neighboring Kenya, despite a lack of convincing evidence that al-Qaeda groups of any significance are operating in Somalia. The prospect of an attack is causing considerable unease in Kenya and enormous fear in Somalia. The fears were sparked by meetings earlier this month between Kenya's President Daniel Arap Moi and high-ranking U.S. State Department officials, at which Moi offered his support for the U.S. as it looks to expand the so-called war on terrorism. Last week, newspapers reported that U.S. officials and special forces personnel had met with Somali officials and scouted out possible targets for a U.S. attack. The White House said yesterday the anthrax used in letter attacks appears to have been produced in the United States, but that the identity of those who mailed them remains a mystery. White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said yesterday the evidence on the anthrax sent to Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy is increasingly, quote, looking like it was a domestic source. Barbara Hatch Rosenberg of the Federation of American Scientists said yesterday that there are perhaps 50 people in the United States with the knowledge to stage such deadly anthrax attacks. India put its army on high alert along the border with Pakistan in the disputed state of Kashmir yesterday after Pakistani troop movements were reported. The move came as India's cabinet called an emergency session to decide its response to the attack on the Indian parliament last Thursday by Muslim Kashmiri militants alleged to be linked to Pakistani intelligence. Nuclear-armed India said it would be within its rights to send troops across the border to hunt militants in Kashmir. Nuclear-armed Pakistan dismissed the allegation of involvement in the parliament attack as fabricated and promised a tough response to any military strike. 33 men armed stormed the presidential palace in Haiti just before dawn yesterday in an apparent coup attempt. At least 7 people were killed before police retook the palace. The attack prompted revenge attacks by Aristide supporters who took to the streets with machetes and torched the homes and offices of opposition leaders. The police said they were searching for dozens of conspirators who escaped. Israel's security forces killed 3 people yesterday, including a Hamas activist and a 12-year-old child, prompting Hamas leaders to announce they would disregard Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's call for an end to attacks on Israelis. In related news, Israeli police yesterday detained a prominent Palestinian official and peace advocate while he was holding a Muslim holiday reception in Jerusalem, calling it a terrorist activity. Sari Nusseibeh, the Palestinian Liberation Organization's most senior official in Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem, was arrested as he hosted a party for European diplomats at the end of Ramadan. Israel's far-right public security minister justified the detention by stating that Palestinian officials holding a meeting in East Jerusalem undermined Israel's sovereignty in the city and therefore constituted a terrorist attack. Australian officials said today asylum seekers protested and then rioted in one of Australia's controversial outback detention centers, setting fire to up to 15 buildings and causing staff to flee. The Attorney General said the protest began as a peaceful demonstration by women and children against conditions in the prison camps, one of six in Australia where undocumented migrants are detained while their cases are assessed, a process that can take years. Senior Bush administration officials said yesterday they're exploring ways to give Otto Reich and Eugene Scalia temporary appointments during the upcoming congressional recess if the Senate doesn't act on them this week. Otto Reich is a former Reagan administration official who ran an illegal covert domestic propaganda effort against Nicaragua's Sandinista government during the 1980s. He's the president's choice to be Secretary of Western Hemispheric Affairs. Eugene Scalia is the son of the conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and a chief supporter of overturning the ergonomic standards proposed by the Clinton administration and supported by every major labor union in the United States. He's now Bush's choice to be the Labor Department's top lawyer. The state of Nevada filed suit today in its continuing effort to prevent the federal government from establishing a nuclear waste burial site at Yucca Mountain, about 90 miles from Las Vegas. The suit argues that under a new rule, the Energy Department plans to disregard the site's geology and make its decision based on alleged safety of the metal canisters that would hold the waste. The proposed nuclear waste site in Nevada sits on an active volcano and earthquake fault. The Bush administration yesterday cleared the way for a gigantic sale of trees charred last year by fires in a national forest in Montana and Idaho, prompting two environmental groups to go to court to challenge the move. The administration action is a victory for the timber industry, which has pushed for an opening of the Bitterroot National Forest to intensive logging. The environmental groups are protesting the method of the administration's decision, which was signed off on by a single official and eliminated the public appeal process normally surrounding such actions. The plan calls for logging 46,000 acres of ponderosa pine trees covering 30 sites within the forest, one of the biggest salvage logging operations in the nation's history.
I'm afraid this masquerade is over, all over, and so is love.
This Masquerade, Philip Bailey of Earth, Wind, and Fire, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, and, well, many blocks right now from another massive fire that is underway up at St. John the Divine, one of the oldest cathedrals in the city. In our first hour, we spoke with activists who edited Another World is Possible, a collection of writings by dissidents, family members of World Trade Center and Pentagon attack victims, and anti-war activists on progressive responses to the September 11th attacks and the U.S. war on Afghanistan. In the same spirit, Bay Area activists gathered last month to present the Mario Savio Award to a leading youth organizer. Mario Savio was one of the leaders of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement and a tireless human rights activist. The recipient of this year's award was Jim Keady, the former St. John's University soccer coach who was fired for his anti-sweatshop activism and went to Indonesia to live with Nike workers on starvation wages before starting his own human rights group. The speech Mario Savio gave in Berkeley in December of 1964, before students launched an occupation of student buildings to demand free speech, would ring as true today. Savio said, quote, "There is a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all." They're words that might have been spoken by Cornel West, who gave the keynote address at the Mario Savio Awards on the challenges facing progressives since September 11th. Today, we're going to spend the rest of the hour listening to Cornel West, professor of African American Studies and Philosophy of Religion at Harvard University.
I appreciate each and every one of you coming out tonight. I hope and pray that I say something that thoroughly unsettles you. Because you can't talk about being a progressive in these times without being unsettled. We're not here to be cajoled, not here to celebrate. We're here to keep the focus where it belongs, and it belongs on folk who are suffering and unnecessarily, folk who are wrestling with forms of social misery, unjustified harm, and unmerited pain. So I want to begin on a Socratic note. Plato says in 38a of that classic Apology, the unexamined life is not worth living. The unexamined life is not a life worthy of human beings. And by human beings, he means we featherless, two-legged, linguistically conscious creatures born between urine and feces. Us. Malcolm X adds, the examined life is painful. We need courage. Courage to think critically, even in the midst of all of the insecurity, vulnerability, invincibility, uncertainty. And we can be told by some of our brothers and sisters of various colors who are fellow citizens that by waving the flag, we cannot think critically. I say, no, no, not at all. We must think critically. But it takes courage to think. And you have to say that in America because it's such a profoundly anti-intellectual civilization. Yeah. Profoundly so. It's market-driven, obsessed with business and short-term game, and it puts a premium on intelligence, which is nothing but a manipulative faculty. We're talking about intellect. Intellect and intelligence, not the same thing. Intelligence engages in immediate valuations of various particular contexts in order to gain access to a short-term gain. Intellect evaluates the evaluations, looks at the hidden presuppositions, the tacit assumptions, what holds a whole framework, a vision, a paradigm together. Let's look at the dogma. And one benchmark of a progressive who musters the courage to think is to look at the dogma of American civilization, beginning with the dogma of white supremacy. Often denied, overlooked, downplayed, act as if it's just the way things are. No, that's not the way things are. We need to question it on every level. Male supremacy, another dogma. People touch it for a bit and act as if it's over. Economic growth by means of corporate priority. It's a dogma. Nobody wants to interrogate it in a Socratic mode. Why does it have to be this way? And of course, since September 11th, I don't know where you were 9/11, but I was in the Big Apple on the 31st floor of the Marriott Marquis in Times Square working with Brother Fernando Ferrer. That was election day that day in New York City. We had spent 4 days going all over the city trying to create a progressive coalition that was unprecedented since the grand moment in Chi-Town with Harold Washington. Yeah. Progressive, yeah. Mayor. And I looked out of my window. I saw a plane crash into the World Trade Center. I said, well, I'm not on crack. What's going on? You all laugh, but I wouldn't laugh. That was serious business. In fact, I figured they're going to blow up Times Square next. Shut down Grand Central Station. Folk running to Times Square. Everybody looking for a room. Put 3-4 folk who don't even know each other in the same room. If that happens in America, you know you got a crisis. And I said, well, how do I muster the courage to think critically and to understand what's going on, especially after that second plane hit? And the first thing that came to mind was the end, not of American innocence. America has never been innocent. Never been innocent. Ask the indigenous peoples how innocent America's been. Ask the descendants of enslaved Africans how innocent America's. No, what struck me was this is the end of American adolescence. This is the end of American adolescence. As I sympathize deeply with the lives of brothers and sisters of all colors in the World Trade Center, I said to myself, for the first time, all Americans will feel unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated as a people. Yeah. And that's precisely what it's been like to be designated a nigger in America from 1619 to 1965. So the challenge became that the whole nation has become niggerized. And does America have the capacity not only to grow old and grow rich and grow big, but also grow up? Maturity. And if you're not willing to join the rest of the world in acknowledging that life is fragile and contingent, and shattered it, the false security and false necessity of your life, then you have a Peter Pan mentality. You don't want to grow up. You want to stay young and youthful forever. Never want to age. No time, no history, no memory, no mortality. Just be American. You have a Disney World sensibility. Comfort. Convenience, contentment, want to have fun. But where's life? Disney World and Disneyland brag no one has ever died on their premises. Quintessentially American. Somebody's probably died and they just pushed them over the line to keep the record clean. But it's ugly. Painful as death is. There's no life where there is no death. And America has been the most death-denying, death-dodging, and death-ducking of modern civilizations. And Socrates says, love of wisdom, philosophy is a preparation for and meditation on death. And America refuses to come to terms with varieties of death, like slavery, social death in the midst of a flawed American democratic experiment. Deny it. Don't mention it in your Constitution. Act as if it's not there. Yeah. Yeah. Keep it at arm's length. Tell mendacious stories about yourself and think that you can skate through history and act as if history won't haunt you and the chickens won't come home to roost. Yeah. civic death, Jim Crow, lynching, act as if America's achieved rough justice when every 2.5 days some black child, a black woman, a black man is hanging from some tree. Spiritual death, teach these people to hate themselves and convince themselves they have the wrong hips and lips and noses and hair texture and skin pigmentation. Maybe you'll be able to control their minds and their bodies and their labor. When will America wrestle with the forms of death so that they'll be able to learn how to die every day? Ms. Louis Farrakhan said, "May and man march with such great wisdom." He said, "White supremacy must die for America to live."
Cornel West, professor of African American Studies and the philosophy of religion at Harvard University, in a speech he gave last month in the Bay Area in honor of Mario Savio, leader of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. You are listening to War and Peace Report. We'll come back to Cornel West in a minute. Blowing Away, Laura Nero here on the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go back to Cornel West, professor of African American Studies, philosophy of religion at Harvard University, author of the best-selling book Race Matters, speaking last month in the Bay Area in California, talking about human rights abroad and at home. Cornel West.
But we add, male supremacy must die, homophobia must die, vast wealth inequality must die, anti-Jewish racism must die, anti-Arab racism must die, class arrogance must die, national haughtiness must die, for America to live, really. So the old legacy of Socrates, that big lip flat nose, pop belly, no shoe wearing, Socrates, is a serious one. But it's all about courage. It takes more courage to muster the exercise of critical intellect than it does for a soldier to fight on the battlefield. A soldier's taking orders from the top, but the courage to muster the exercise of critical intellect means you have to look at yourself. One of the problems of progressives often is that we tend to be so self-righteous that we can point the finger at everybody else, but don't really want to look at ourselves. Got white progressives doing wonderful things, wanting to deal with a variety of issues, but still know they haven't really dealt with the challenge of the vicious legacy of white supremacy and the police brutality and criminal justice system and prison industrial complex. They didn't wonder why, in fact, we're not more multiracial. Or the black freedom movement, black folk willing to die for black freedom. But then the sisters come along and want to talk about patriarchy and male supremacy. Yeah. And all of a sudden you say, well, we're going to get to that later. Sooner or later, we're going to touch on that. But we talking about blackness now. No, they black too. working people come along, where the vast majority of people of color are working people. Where's the labor movement in your considerations of your conceptions of freedom? And gay brothers like James Baldwin and lesbian sisters like Audre Lorde step forward and say, if you can't keep track of my humanity, then you got a truncated vision. And the same is true of all of the fraction movement. And if we cannot find some overlapping common ground, then the powers that be, and especially the corporate elites, will continue to reign in such a way that they shape the world in their own image. And we've seen it in Indochina, in Africa, in Latin America, around the world. And we're at a moment now where the American people are very open to something beyond their egos. It's just that patriotism and narrow forms of nationalism can fill that void. They're hungry and thirsty for something bigger than them. And if progressives cannot intervene with a broad vision that keeps track of the wretched of the earth, then we miss this opportunity. And it is a very delicate moment right now. Gangsters all around the world of various colors are highly encouraged. It's true. Because they moved to center stage. Even got the President of the United States, head of the greatest empire of late modernity, talking about them. The 472 white supremacist militia groups, all excited now. Even though none of them appeared on the list of the president. Not one. But it's not just white gangsters. Got Asian gangsters and African gangsters, and Latin American gangsters, all up now, extending their state powers and hunting down various folk like they're cockroaches. Look at the United States now. Kangaroo courts, military tribunes. What in the world is that? Hardly any rights or liberty. I thought that Bush was a free marketeer. I thought he feared government. I thought he was suspicious of governmental intervention. I thought wrong. Bush administrators, don't you realize in a deep crisis we need governmental intervention? Governmental power is very important. I said, you got to be kidding. Say that again. But the question, of course, is whose crisis we're talking about. Progressives have been calling for Marshall plans in cities. They've been calling for governmental intervention with significant resources for the children, the most vulnerable ones. They've been talking about trying in some way to focus on those downsized, marginalized workers who have been viewed as just some moment in some philosophic calculus for corporate elites. But when it comes to that crisis, pull back. When it comes to the crisis of brothers and sisters who the Bush administration and others think are like them, it's a major crisis. And you say, my God, what level of hypocrisy. And as I sat there in that room in the hotel and began to listen to the radio, and I said, tears ought to flow. These are loved ones, and each life is precious. But if Americans of all colors cannot connect the tears of Diallo's mother to the tears that are flowing for those in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, we've got a selective morality. It's hypocritical. It's mendacious. Nothing wrong with shedding tears for people that you love. But if your way of being in the world is such that you can be silent in the face of the plight of the victims of death squads in Honduras under CIA-sponsored exodus, and all of a sudden cry tears of those in the World Trade Center, then are you really just a tribal nation and still have yet to really grow up? And if we don't have some progressives who say, not just to this nation, but to the world, that a baby in Iraq and a baby in Guatemala and a baby in Tel Aviv and a baby on the West Bank and a baby in Oakland and a baby in Chicago all have exactly the same value. If we can't say that, then we don't have a progressive movement. We're just playing games. You're just playing games. Now, one of the things about Socrates is like Jesus, he never wrote a word. And I don't encourage students at UC Berkeley to imitate that. Imitation is always suicide. Always, as Ralph Waldo Emerson said. But the Socrates that we know comes from three sources. Profound, yet in the end, unpersuasive dialogues of Plato. Because he is profound, he's just wrong, but that's all right. That's all right, you don't have to be right all the time. It's the insights, and it's the play of the mind that forces, unsettles, wrestles. The less fascinating dialogues are Xenophon and the satirical depiction of Socrates and Aristophanes as the clouds, three sources of Socrates. But what's fascinating is, in the depiction of Socrates in those three sources, those textual sources, we never see Socrates shed a tear. Never. And he only laughs once. Now, something is wrong. And as progressives, even as we affirm the courage to think critically, we must never allow the intellect to become a refuge for the emotionally deprived. You have to think as a whole person, all the way down. And so the Socratic note has to be supplemented with a prophetic note if we're talking about being a progressive, especially in these difficult times. And what do I mean by prophetic? I'm talking about the legacies of Jerusalem. The heartbreak of a Jeremiah as he foretells the destruction of Jerusalem. The tears of an Amos as he looks and has to say, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. The powerful verse in the New Testament said Jesus wept. Why? Because he loved so Lazarus, Jerusalem. Muhammad walking into Mecca, mediating conflict, pluralism, with mutual respect and civility. I'm not talking about the perverters of Islam and gangsters like bin Laden. I'm talking about purveyors of Islam, keeping track on mercy, justice, compassion. And so in part our challenge is, how do we bring together what a distinguished graduate of this institution, Josiah Royce, called the spirituality of genuine questioning and doubting and interrogating with the legacy of Jerusalem, which is the spirituality of genuine compassion and service to others. Because you can have the most sophisticated and acute analysis of power in the world, but if you don't have compassion in your soul and love in your heart, you're still going to end up with a movement that cannot touch people at the deepest level and in the end reproduce structures of domination that are unaccounted for with those leaders who claim to be speaking on behalf of common folk. And part of the problem of progressives in the United States is that we have become so marginal that we can't wait to get just a little visibility. And we get a little visibility, the focus is no longer on the cause itself, but more and more is focused on certain persons. And how do you ensure that the focus is not on you? It's part and parcel of how much compassion you really have for the folk that you're fighting for. And that's a question of quality of person and character, and all of us fall short. No one of us are pure and pristine. No one of us free of spot or wrinkle. But we've got to be honest about this as progressives. You see, that in the end, without the deep compassion that cuts across the race and class and nation and sexual orientation, it becomes sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. Now, if I were to exemplify the coming together of the spirituality of genuine doubting and questioning with the spirituality of genuine love and compassion, I could just turn John Coltrane's Love Supreme on and sit down. Just sit down. Just listen to it. Come to terms with it. Because he comes out of a tradition of a blues people. And a blues people are inquisitive people, always asking questions that make the nation uncomfortable. But they're dealing with levels of misery that are rendered invisible, but the blues is a sweet and sad indictment of that misery.
That's right.
That's the Socratic and the prophetic brought together. We could just look at a chapter in Toni Morrison's Beloved.
Yeah.
Look at Baby Suggs in the clearing. Giving her heart to others, trying to get them to be inspired in a context in which it looks as if they are so unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated that they want to go to the crack house. But she says, no, don't go. And now that the whole nation has the blues, can they learn that from a blues people?
Yeah.
That's part of the question. So far, very few are looking. Very few are turning there. But as progressives, we ought to know that there are some resources there, some very deep resources there, that allows us to say, in a spirit of deep, loving critique, that Mr. Bush, you have no right to engage in a Manichaean and melodramatic conception of a pure, innocent America against foreign terrorists and gangsters.
That's right.
You have no right. If you're gonna be against gangsterism and terrorism, then be honest about who are gangsters and who are terrorists.
Right.
Be honest about it. We all ought to be against gangsterism and terrorism. But there's no way that America somehow is exempt from those categories.
No way.
There are freedom-loving Democrats of every nation, every race, every gender, every sexual orientation. And there are gangsters of every nation, every race, every gender, every sexual orientation. And a Manichaean and melodramatic conception of the world conceives of pure heroes and pure villains, with all the good on one side and all the bad on the other, with some happy ending owing to some imperial mentality that guarantees triumph. John Wayne is one example. Depending on which movie, brother. John Ford's a complicated brother. We don't have time to get into that right now. But the point is that when you conceive of yourself as a moral exemplar to the world and the city on the hill that transcends all of history and all of time, the chosen people that somehow has some direct line to the deity, it's hard to get beyond the melodramatic. Very hard to get beyond the melodramatic. And one of the reasons why progressives have such a difficult time gaining a foothold in American culture is because it's hard to shake that melodramatic conception of America, the conception it has of itself. Sometimes investing progressives themselves as if they are the chosen ones.
Cornel West, professor of African American Studies and Philosophy of Religion at Harvard University, speaking at the Mario Savio Awards last month in the Bay Area in California. We're going to come back to this speech in just a minute. And by the way, if you want to get information on this videotape, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921 for information on the videotape of this Cornel West speech. Stay with us.
My love for the world is like always, for the world is a part of me. That's why I'm so afraid of the progress that's been made toward eternity. Every morning, noon and night finds me hoping that everything's all right. The world is in an uproar, the danger zone is everywhere.
Danger Zone, Brother Ray. That's Ray Charles here on the War and Peace Report. This is the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to one of those exceptions, Cornel West, as he continues with his speech given last month in the Bay Area. Cornel West, professor of African American Studies and Philosophy of Religion at Harvard University.
As if they are the vessels of pure virtue. And one of the legacies of a blues people is that the good and evil shot through all of us. All of us. Contributions. Marcus Garvey, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Minister Louis Farrakhan, and others. He says, I don't worry about white brothers and sisters running up to me and saying, I know I'm not a racist. I've transcended that. My aunt and uncle have more work to do, but not me. Because I'm wrestling with the white supremacy in black folk. If there's white supremacy in black folk, I know in vanilla suburbs, it's got to be much thicker than white brothers and sisters think, be they progressive or not. And if that's the case, then it means it's really the quality of our struggle against these various forms of evil that need to be accented. Not whether we are pure vessels of virtue. Now, what does this have to do with where we are today? Well, it has much to do with where we are today, because this is a frightening moment. It was terrifying before September 11th. We had a crisis before September 11th. All you had to do is look at the children, look at the working people's wages. Look at the prison industrial complex. Look at the drug war, which was a war against poor youth, disproportionately black and brown. Already had a crisis, but it's now multi-layered. It's now multi-layered. Because in such a moment, paranoia and hysteria becomes hegemonic and pervasive. People begin to look for alternatives, and oftentimes they'll grab at straws, you see. And so it mustn't occur to think critically and tell the truth in the spirit of compassion to fellow citizens. We have to shake them, because so many of us are asleep on our feet and need to be pricked. Like a stingray that bites, gets folks to try to think differently. One of the ways we do that is to first try to connect ourselves with the best of the history. You see. Because with the Socratic and the prophetic note is that precious democratic note. And democracies are so rare in human history, they tend not to last too long. And levels of paranoia undermine the very conditions for the possibility of democracy. When freedom is presented, people often escape from freedom, as Eric Fromm says. They'd rather defer to authority. Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor, Brothers Karamazov. To be a progressive is to be against the thick forms of conformity, complacency, compliance, and cowardice. All four. And it is to believe, as radical Democrats, democratic socialists, feminists, womanists, anti-homophobic freedom fighters, whatever you call yourself, I would just say you're a decent human being, but we got all these labels. But whatever you call yourself concerned with these issues, it means, one, you have to bear witness in terms of the kind of person you want to be. Yeah. Regardless of what you think are the short-term effects and consequences. If we say, I am an Arab American today because they are being targeted. I am a Muslim American today because they are being targeted. Yes, you might not be popular. Who cares? We're not in this for a popularity contest. That's the kind of life we want to live. That's the kind of person we want to be. That's the kind of way we want to go out if we got to go out. That's the kind of trace we want to leave, the kind of legacy we want to leave. I hear black folks, in a recent poll, the group most likely to support racial profiling the Arab brothers and sisters. Now, it's hard for me to believe that poll because I got a bias, but I said, damn, all the hell we didn't come. And I guess it's partly understandable. You say, yeah, let somebody else have it for a while and get a little relief. But it lacks ethical substance. Now, of course, we can go back to our Arab brothers and sisters and say, it's not like you've been crazy about us for the last 10 years. Right. Kind of keep a little distance from the Negroes.
That's right.
And now you need us and everybody else. And I'm saying you got some black folk who are going to be with you anyway, even given what your history is. Because it's right and moral and just. But it's not just about persons. As real as it is, the immediate targets, thousands and thousands of folk in detention right now since September 11th, just like Mumia Abu-Jamal in detention for almost 17 years. Targeted by the repressive apparatus of the U.S. nation state. Vicious repressive apparatus. In the name of security for some, you see, cleaning things up for some. No, to be a Democrat is to say, as that genius from this part of the world, Sly Stone, put it, everyday people have a depth, a geniality, a bigness of heart, mind, and soul that is potential and could be actualized if their voices are heard at the highest levels of the decision-making processes in those institutions that guide and regulate their lives. There's no accident that the Negro National Anthem must lift every
voice.
It's no accident that the greatest democratic art form to come out of not just only this country, but any other country in the world, which is jazz, is all about finding your voice. The Janie Crawford in their eyes were watching God is trying to find her voice. John Coltrane couldn't imitate Johnny Hodges for too long because he had to find his voice. It's all about finding your voice, and when you find your voice, you have a courage to just speak, to reflect about what you're speaking about and be willing to live and die for what you're highlighting in your speech that focuses on the plight of everyday people. Because everybody's a star, Sly said. Well, as Muhammad Ali put it, ain't nobody like me, ain't nobody gonna be like me. That's democratic individuality. That's not bourgeois individualism. Each one of us unique, distinctive, irreducible. No one like us, everyone unusual. And there's an extraordinariness in ordinary folk. There's a miraculous in the quotidian, as Ralph Waldo Emerson put it. That's a democratic sensibility. And if you don't believe it, then you don't believe really in democracy. It's just a little fig leaf to hide and conceal your oligarchic economy and your white supremacists and male supremacists and homophobic practices. You're not really a Democrat. Small D. You can't understand the workers' movement. How could you be a Democrat when their voices are not heard in the workplace? What a challenge. Now, it could be the case that American civilization really doesn't have the capacity to be a full-fledged democracy. That's a real possibility. The greatest text ever written on this civilization, Lexis de Tocqueville in 1835 and 1840, volume 1 and 2. He came here and said, this is a fascinating place, a lot of democratic sensibilities, but there's something here that's deeply American, but not democratic at all.
That's it.
That last chapter, the biggest chapter in the text, in the first volume. He says, this place does not have the capacity to be a multiracial democracy.
Overlooked.
They might not even have the capacity to be a classless democracy. It's a capitalist democracy with white privilege. And they might include some exceptional black and brown and yellow and red folk. But democracy is not about just making place for the bourgeois elements of these various peoples of color. If you can't deal with their cousins on the corner, then you haven't met the challenge. When Marcus Garvey raised the most terrifying question ever raised in America, he said, deep down, the vast majority of white fellow citizens will act KKK-like when it comes to political, economic, and sexual competition. They talk a good game. But these chocolate folk move to the cities and white flight takes place. Move to the schools and new schools show up. Don't really want to embrace. You say Mr. Garvey is a harsh conclusion, but it's certainly an inescapable challenge. And progressives must take seriously Garvey's question. He said, as long as black people are outside of Africa, their lives will be lives of ruin and disaster. He said, Mr. Garvey, when's the last time you looked at Africa? Legacies of European colonialism, decrepit African bourgeois leadership, lies of disaster, ruin. And the words of Henry Holland Garnett echoed down through the corridors of time, never confused the plight of people of African descent with those of the Israelite in the Old Testament. For black folk, pharaohs on both sides of the bloody Red Sea. Nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. Somebody sing a song. Maybe the freedom will be in how we relate to one another to reform and revolutionize the very white supremacist America that has so utterly denied us and others. What am I saying? I'm saying in part. You are very patient. I'm saying in part. You cannot talk about being a progressive in American civilization and being a Democrat, radical Democrat, small d, without putting the struggle against the vicious legacy of white supremacy at or near the center of your program. You can't do it. Other issues are crucial. Ecological abuse, crucial. Wealth inequality, fundamental. But the litmus test, the Achilles heel, is this legacy of white supremacy, because if you deal with that legacy, then you'll be forced to raise the other kinds of questions, because when it comes to where so much of the ecological abuse is taking place, when it comes to the vast majority of these peoples of color who are working and underemployed and unemployed, when it comes to decrepit schools and unavailable child care and inadequate health care, if you're dealing with the legacy of white supremacy, you're going to have to deal with these other issues in a serious way.
Yes.
But if you're dealing with these issues and somehow sidestepping that legacy of white supremacy, then we end up still so distant, separated by that veil that the great Du Bois talked about in 1903. And how do we do this? How do we forge ahead? Well, as you all know, I've been spending a lot of time with old brother Al Sharpton, part of the exploratory committee. People say, oh, Brother West, why are you spending time with him? My God, he's still wearing his hair like James Brown. Come on. I say, I don't idealize or idolize anybody. I'm a Christian, you see. I know everybody, who they are. But the question is, what kind of voice can make an intervention at the national level in terms of linking the vicious legacy of white supremacy and how we wrestle with it to the issues of wealth inequality, corporate power here and around the world?
Cornel West, professor of African American Studies, Philosophy of Religion at Harvard University, speaking last month in the Bay Area at the event honoring Mario Savio. The award given last month was to Jim Keady as he fights slave labor in Indonesia. Cornel West's speech, if you want to get information on the videotape, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Special thanks to our video team, Karen Renucci, Dee Dee Halleck, Emily Kunstler, Molly Fink-Schneider, Warcry, Chase Pearson. Today, also Angela Alston, Jamil Graham, and Elise Stepanian, Liza Baer as well. Democracy Now! in Exile is broadcasting from Downtown Community Television, thanks to John Alpert and Keiko Suno. I want to thank KPFA and KFCF in Fresno and all the Pacifica affiliates who are airing our program, We Are Pacifica. We're also broadcasting on Manhattan Neighborhood Network in New York, Channel 34 and 56, on Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 of the Dish Network, on Shortwave Radio, and on the internet, wbix.org, webactive.com. Our website is democracynow.org. And you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. We're still looking for Mac laptop computers. In Exile, from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Keeps right on growing. And what does a mother get in return for the life of the son she's lost?